Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noll Show. And now, your host, Gary Noll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, a special in-depth original investigative report. The safety and efficacy of vaccines in general, but specifically today on the vaccines for the human papillomavirus, including Gardasil. My concern as a public health educator and an advocate of someone who has spent my entire adult career studying phenomena is that I am perplexed at how many millions of individuals are taking a vaccine with the promise that it will prevent cervical cancer and other cancers when there is absolutely no proof to that. There are no long-term studies. We have never gotten to the place where the people who would be protected have met the age requirements of having gone through 25, 30, 35, or 40 years of life before we would see, would a vaccine protect this? We're basing all this upon theoretical and mathematical models. Who creates these? The manufacturer of the vaccines. Who are the experts who testify before Congress, who sit on the FDA and CDC advisory boards? The scientists for hire from the vaccine companies. How is it that almost every state right now and for the past several years has been pushing for mandatory vaccines, in some cases succeeding, like with the flu vaccine, with very high doses, as much as 24 micrograms of thimerosal, the ethyl mercury, that we know is neurotoxic, and now they're promoting Gardasil because of what is called ALEC. ALEC is an acronym for the American Legislative Exchange Council, a group of 300-plus major multinational corporations who, in secret, for the better part of 35 years, have been having semi-annual meetings with state legislators. They propose to the state legislators bills. They get the state legislators to sign off on the bill in their own secret sessions, legislative sessions. They then go back to their states and then propose these new health measures and make these bills into laws. And because they have multiple state legislators at these ALEC meetings, they generally have bipartisan support. So the public, the media, assume that if they want to mandate a vaccine like Gardasil for all young girls and boys in a state, it's only because of a policy of protecting the citizens based upon sound science and nothing more. Indeed, nothing could be further from the truth. Today, we will be exploring the vaccine safety and efficacy. This will also be followed by an in-depth article, an original investigative report on the science, or the lack thereof, of the safety and efficacy of Gardasil. It will be posted on our website with one of our scholars in residence and myself. Today's panelists will include Dr. Tony Bark, a pediatric physician, a homeopathic physician practicing in Chicago. She is well known within the homeopathic community. She is a graduate with her medical degree from Rush Medical College, a very prestigious school, and her pediatric internship at New York University. She also has degrees in psychology, as well as a master's degree in healthcare emergency management from Boston University Medical School. Additionally, and her website is disease-reversal.com. She will be joined in studio by Lou M. Panessi. Lou M. Panessi has been an oncological nurse, a nurse administrator at Long Island Jewish Hospital, with more than 100 employees under her, as well as having had a cathartic moment, an epiphany, nearly 19 years ago, where all that she had been taught from a conservative medical background, she was challenged with, and she made a choice. We'll hear about that today in studio. But joining us in short segments will be a panel that I recently filmed for a new documentary on the safety and efficacy of vaccines. This will include Dr. Nancy Banks, board-certified OBGYN, obstetrician gynecologist, and a Harvard Medical School grad. She also has 25 years of experience in the field. She has taught, and she has an MBA in addition in finance. She will be joined by Dr. Lucia Tomanovich, and Dr. Tomanovich is well known for her work in the area of adjuvants, including aluminum, upon brain chemistry. She has a PhD in biochemistry from the Comparative Genomics Center at James Cook University in Australia, highly prestigious school, and she is now a member of the Neurodynamics Research Group Department at the University of British Columbia. She has worked there with renowned neuroscientist Professor Christopher Shaw, and they are currently researching and publishing in peer-reviewed literature and presenting to scientific groups around the world the neurotoxic effects of aluminum vaccine adjuvants. She is also the associate editor of the peer-reviewed journal of Alzheimer's disease. And they will also be joined by Dr. Meryl Nass. She is a board-certified physician in internal medicine, and she is also one of the few physicians that I have met over the decades who were willing to look at Gulf War syndrome as something other than it's all in your mind. Well, it wasn't all in the mind. It was indeed due to many things, not the least of which were the experimental vaccines, the anthrax, and the botulism vaccine that every single vet who went to the first Gulf War conflict in 1991 had to get, and every vet going overseas since has received. And she has done remarkable work in that area. In fact, she is one of the leaders of the Anthrax Vaccine Immunization Coalition to fight this, and she has testified to 4 congressional committees about anthrax vaccines and their impact upon a person's system. She's an expert in multiple chemical sensitivities. That represents our panel. Now, to the individuals who will be you'll be hearing, and I'll do a short introduction to each of their clips on important topics. Let us now go to begin our program, which is a 2-hour documentary special, 2-hour original special, on the question of the safety and efficacy of vaccines, and specifically today, Gardasil. You know, the Gardasil vaccine that the governor of New Jersey and the state legislature members of New Jersey have tried to push upon the public, where every legislature in the country is being talked with to make it mandatory, where parents are told you're irresponsible or you're a bad parent if you don't give this vaccine, where the American media, especially the reprehensibly inept doctors on CNN and some famous surgeons on television, will suck up to the pharmaceutical industry because of what it gives them, but will not have the courage to go on and challenge the vaccine industry or U.S. public health fraud on vaccines, those doctors. Here's the other side of this story.
Merck and one other pharmaceutical company have been promoting a vaccine against cervical cancer. First of all, there's no proof that HPV causes cervical cancer. Association is not causation. There's no proof that this vaccine works. The vaccine was only tested for 4 years before they put it on the market. Of course, cervical cancer does not show up in women until they're in their 40s, 50s, or 60s. So how is it you're going to give a 13-year-old, a 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old girl this vaccine and think that it's going to prevent something that happens to her 50 years later? And we've had a number of deaths with this vaccine. We've had some children who are developing long-term medical conditions, which we have no idea whether they're going to reverse. And so we're giving a vaccine which is totally useless, which has no proof that it has any efficacy, and has solid proof that it is harmful. And yet people are sacrificing their young daughters to the vaccine gods.
That was Dr. Nancy Banks. Now we're going to hear about Gardasil's adverse reactions and case histories and statistics, legitimate independent statistics.
There have been numerous reports of serious autoimmune reactions affecting the nervous system in girls following HPV vaccinations. And for the most part, the medical regulatory agencies and the health authorities have dismissed them as being coincidental and completely unrelated to the vaccine. But the fact is that the reports of adverse reactions are increasing in numbers, and there is now over 60% of adverse reactions reported for HPV vaccines alone in the U.S. vaccine adverse reaction database verse. There is over 60% of serious adverse reactions, over 60% of all deaths, and 82% of cases of permanent disability in females under the age of 30 associated with Gardasil. In the UK, the rate of adverse reactions from Cervarix, which is another HPV vaccine, is 24 to 100 times higher than that of any other vaccine in the immunization schedule. In Australia, there is over 50% of adverse reactions reported that are attributable to HPV vaccines. Now, in addition to that, there are numerous case reports and studies in the scientific literature that show that HPV vaccines are associated with serious neurological outcomes and autoimmune disorders. The medical health authorities have by large dismissed all these reports as coincidental and unrelated to the vaccine, but I have done so without any adequate investigations.
The primary reason that most young women and men are receiving the human papilloma virus vaccine is because it will prevent cancer. So let's address the issue of claims to prevent cancer and the efficacy of the vaccine.
So we were recently approached by two mothers whose daughters have died approximately 6 months following vaccinations with the HPV vaccines. And they shared a similar story. Both girls showed similar symptoms, mainly affecting the nervous system, and it included loss of memory, so periods of amnesia, difficulties in speech, periods of confusion and psychosis. They also have problems controlling their movements. And in both cases, the symptoms started after the first shot, and one girl died after the second dose of Gardasil, and another girl died after the third dose of Gardasil. In both cases, the autopsy revealed absolutely no anatomical finding, no microbiological finding, and no toxicological finding that could have explained why these girls died. And it was included simply that the case was unrelated to the vaccine. In addition, the autopsy analysis allegedly revealed no signs of brain inflammation. So they concluded again that it was not possible that deaths were caused by the vaccine. We, however, decided to look further into the issue, and we did a more comprehensive analysis on the brain samples that were provided to us by the coroner's office. We looked for various immunoinflammatory markers, and we also looked for the presence of HPV16L1 particles in the girls' brains. HPV16L1 is the antigenic component of the Gardasil vaccine. Vaccines are not normally supposed to cross the blood-brain barrier. If they do cross the blood-brain barrier, they can trigger inflammatory reactions and abnormal immune processes. And in general, it is not thought that vaccines can pose a hazard to the nervous system. However, when we did our analysis, we found that HPV-16 L1 particles from the Gardasil vaccine have actually penetrated through the blood-brain barrier. We found that they were present in all brain specimens we analyzed from both girls. There was also a mark activation of abnormal immune pathways in the brain to suggest that basically the immune system in the brain has been activated because of the presence of these foreign antigens from the vaccine, and it was now triggering an autoimmune reaction that was basically destroying the brain tissue. In particular, we found that blood vessels in the brain were affected. Our additional analysis shows that there were hemorrhages in the brain, and hemorrhages really indicate that there is damage to the cerebral vasculature. Now, this is really important because another finding that emerged from our analysis is that HPV-16 antibodies, which recognize the particle that's in the vaccine, have also showed reactivity, and they were binding to the walls of blood vessels in the brain. This means that the antibodies that is raised against the vaccine antigen is not only recognizing the vaccine antigen, it's also recognizing your own tissue. In the cases that we analyzed, it was the wall of blood vessels in the brain. So what this means in simple terms is that the immune system is basically turning itself on and attacking the blood vessels in the brain, targeting them for destruction, which would explain why we found brain hemorrhages. In one of the cases, the autopsy revealed brain edema, which again, together with the hemorrhages, is suggestive of breakdown of the blood-brain barrier. A lot of the girls display symptoms of brain inflammation and encephalopathy. And there was other evidence on our histological analysis that cells in particular areas of the brain showed ischemic changes, which basically tell you that there has been a disrupted blood flow to this area of the brain. And again, this points to an underlying vascular disorder in the brain, which explains why these girls died suddenly and way prior their time. They're all teenage girls in there. One was 14 and the other one was 15. One was Canadian Caucasian, another one was from New Zealand, Maori descent. They had nothing in common other than Gardasil, and they had no underlying disorder, and there was no history of drug use. And they had no significant previous history of any medical conditions, nor they suffered from autoimmune disorders. So the only thing they had in common was Gardasil and presence of HPV-16L1.
That is Dr. Lucia Tominovic talking about what happens inside the brain. And as you heard her discuss, brain hemorrhaging. So think of how many children today are having problems with their brain, and yet we are refusing to acknowledge an association between the ingredients, including aluminum, in most vaccines and any form of brain pathology. The next person you're about to hear is Dr. Meryl Nass, and it's all about the FDA approval of vaccines, and especially the CancerVax and the FDA Merck approval letter.
What I'd wanted to talk about with respect to Gardasil is how limited the information may be that is available to FDA at the time it licenses a drug. Now, Gardasil vaccines are considered drugs by FDA. So Gardasil was a new class of drug. It was going to be the first anti-cancer, cancer preventive vaccine / drug. And so it got one of these reviewed 6-month approvals. And at the time it was approved, if you read the approval letter that FDA sent to Merck, you will be shocked to see that Merck had not proved that it was effective at preventing cervical cancer, had not shown whether it caused birth defects in women who might be pregnant when they got the vaccine or become pregnant shortly thereafter. Had not shown its effectiveness against genital warts, hadn't shown whether if the vaccine worked against the strain, the four strains of virus that it was alleged to be effective for, whether a different population of viruses would then come into the human population and cause cervical cancer or other conditions like genital warts. And that's important because the pneumococcal vaccine that was approved for children initially, there have been several now, caused a reduction in the pneumococcal bacterial strains that the virus included, but led to a change in the population of pneumococcal bacteria in general, so that there was the potential for actually more virulent pneumococcal illnesses occurring as a result of vaccination within the population. And so there are concerns now that Gardasil or other vaccines that may lead to a change in the milieu, the bacterial or viral milieu, that people in general are exposed to, and there may develop actually more significant illnesses later, or certainly equivalent illnesses. So FDA required Merck to perform over a dozen studies, which were going to be completed up to 10 years or longer after the vaccine was licensed, to determine how safe, how effective it was, how long the effect might last, and even how stable the vaccine was. When it was licensed, they didn't even know if the vaccine would be good at 36 months, and yet it was approved for 36 months. There are other things FDA asked the manufacturer to do that have been blanked out, have been marked over so that you can't read them in the approval letter, and one wonders what might be there.
That was Dr. Merrill Nass. Now let's go back to Dr. Lucia Tomanovich and have her explain the science. Will this vaccine actually prevent what it's claimed, cancer? Because virtually all the advocates, all the people within the state legislatures who are trying to mandate it, the people at the FDA and CDC, they're all singing from the same choir book here that it will prevent cervical cancer. Do they have the actual science to prove this, or is this just another propaganda campaign?
So Gardasil received fast-track approval in 2006 by the U.S. FDA. The advertising campaign for Gardasil actually started a year earlier before the final data on safety and efficacy were available. And at that time, Gardasil was actually promoted as a cervical cancer vaccine, even though there was absolutely zero data to support that claim. And even now, 6 years later, there is zero data to support the claim that Gardasil can prevent cervical cancer. And in spite of this, medical health authorities around the world, as well as Merck, the vaccine manufacturers, have these outrageous claims that Gardasil can prevent cervical cancer. And the US FDA and the CDC, and this is basically a quote, they say that they recommend Gardasil vaccination for prevention of cancers. Merck says Gardasil does more than prevent cervical cancer. It protects against other HPV diseases too. Now, all these claims are at significant odds with factual evidence, because the truth of the matter is that cervical cancer takes 20 to 30 years to develop, and the longest clinical trial data from Merck is 5 years. So the vaccine has thus far prevented zero cases of cervical cancers and zero cases of death from cervical cancers. What they've done in clinical trials is that they used precancerous lesions as a marker for prevention of cancers. And the claim was made that because Gardasil was about 100% efficacious in clearing HPV 16 and 18 related lesions, which account for about 70% of all cervical cancer, that meant that Gardasil would prevent 70% of all cervical cancers. To make these kinds of extrapolations is really far-fetched because in the real world, women can acquire multiple HPV infections. So if one really wants to have any clue about the overall effectiveness of the vaccine, one needs to look at the data that shows what the effectiveness is against all HPV types, not just 16 and 18, because there are about 15 high-risk HPV types that are associated with cervical cancer. And that data exists from Merck, and it shows that the vaccine efficacy against all high-risk types is between 16.9%, which is not significant, to 70%. So the middle ground is about 40% efficacy. And that's not something that the Merck is very eager to advertise because it wouldn't really support the selling of their product. But the health agencies and the regulatory authorities choose to ignore that crucial data, and they make these sweeping claims of 70% of reduction of cervical cancer, and they have zero data to support that. And the problem is that most of the public is unaware of that. The whole premise of a fast-track approval is that the drug needs to demonstrate superior effectiveness and safety than the existing procedure. Now, pap screening and the excision procedures have demonstrably cut down cervical cancer mortality rates. On the other hand, neither Gardasil nor Cervarix have prevented one single case of cervical cancer. So they're demonstrably not more effective than pap screening, so why on earth have they been fast-tracked on the market?
Could it be because they're very profitable? We're going to go back now to Dr. Lucia Tomanovich to take a more in-depth look at the pap smear, which I recommend, have always recommended, and any reasonable person would recommend women take the pap smear because it's non-invasive. And it is the best way of determining what is happening instead of taking the drug. Listen carefully what she said. Not a single case of cervical cancer has been prevented. You wouldn't know that from all the promotion around Gardasil or the other human papillomavirus vaccines.
There is another aspect that's very disturbing, which is, well, we know that pharmaceutical companies are out there to make money, and that's no secret. So the fact that they are maybe exaggerating their efficacy and safety data is understandable. But the fact that the regulatory agencies jump on that same bandwagon, and now they're acting nothing more than as a spokesperson for the pharmaceutical industry, That is unacceptable. What you routinely see from the medical health authorities, that they present partial information to the public in a way that generates fear and promotes vaccine uptake. They will say, for example, that cervical cancer is the second leading cause of death, that there is 250,000 of women dying every year from cervical cancer. Well, that is true, but they don't tell you the second part of information, which is 88% of these deaths from cervical cancer occur in developing countries which have no pap screening programs. Now, the pap screening programs have helped achieve a 70% reduction in cervical cancer mortality in places like Canada and US. There is no need for a HPV vaccine in places where you have regular pap screening, because the vaccine will never accomplish what pap screening has been able to accomplish. So it will not reduce the cervical cancer beyond what has already been achieved with regular screening and the loop electrosurgical procedure. So there is little doubt that HPV vaccines can cause serious neurological outcomes and autoimmune diseases, and in certain cases even deaths. The only thing that is debatable is how common such adverse reactions are. Well, let me ask you a question. Do you know anyone who suffered cerebral vasculitis and died after a pap screen? Bottom line is, again, the vaccines are neither safer nor more effective than pap screens. So altogether, they basically fail to satisfy the very criteria required for fast approval, for fast-track approval.
Now let's hear Dr. Merrill Nass talk about the risks of doses and boosters and the adverse reactions.
No, children don't usually die suddenly when they're healthy. And you have to find a reason for that. And there are certainly lots of teenage girls who have died relatively suddenly after Gardasil or developed severe neurologic reactions. And therefore, I mean, if you're going to try to balance safety and efficacy when you prescribe something like a vaccine, you have to know how effective it's going to be. Does this really prevent cervical cancer in young women? And does it prevent it in women who've already been exposed to these viruses? And what happens after a girl gets a number of doses of this vaccine? What is the risk then of an adverse effect? Is it because each time you get another dose, you boost the number of memory cells and antibodies significantly, so that it's very likely that you could go three or four doses. Well, you get three initially for Gardasil, and then if it lasts, say, 5 years, which is what some people have suggested, you're getting a booster every 5 years. You may have a serious adverse reaction 5, 10, 15 years down the road from a booster. So if you know, I don't know how other doctors prescribe something like Gardasil when it's impossible to figure out what the risk-benefit equation is.
Dr. Tomanovich discusses the boys' herd immunity argument.
And now the reason that the HPV vaccines are not being pushed on boys, or strongly recommended, to use a more politically correct term, is that the immunization rates in girls are dropping down. So now they want to immunize boys for the sake of herd immunity. Well, if the problem with that is, again, the whole concept of herd immunity with a disease that it's not even contagious in such environments is problematic. Again, you can acquire HPV infection through sexual contact. It's not something that's transmissible by air.
So Dr. Nass then addresses, how did Gardasil get approval for boys?
When Gardasil was approved, FDA deferred any studies in males under 18. And yet, 3 years later, they approved the product for boys age 9 and above. So we know that no studies were begun 3 years earlier, and there probably was very little data when it was approved for boys. And why would you want to give boys a vaccine for genital, 9-year-old boys, a vaccine for genital warts? Genital warts are a sexually transmitted disease. What is the necessity of a 9-year-old boy getting this vaccine, particularly since it may only work 3 to 5 years, which hopefully is before they become sexually active.
But Dr. Nass then addresses the larger general question on Gardasil vaccine trials and how little study is done on their safety.
You would think that adverse reactions may develop many months or even years later. But vaccine trials usually last 30 to 60 days. With Gardasil, some of the trials that the manufacturer required did go out to 6 months, and by requiring the manufacturer to conduct a pregnancy registry for several years, and some of the trials did go out for years, they were going to collect data for a longer period. But most vaccines that are now on the market that have been licensed for a long time had very minimal data collection for safety.
And then we'll conclude this segment of our program with a discussion of the research on the human papillomavirus presented to the UK health authorities.
We recently received a response from the UK Medical Health Authority addressing our case study, which found evidence that that HPV vaccines can, in certain cases, cause death and fatal autoimmune adverse reactions. The response we received from the UK Medical Health Authority commenting our recent research on HPV vaccine safety, if you would allow me to read, because I would not like to misquote what they said. So, the department, therefore, has no plans to review the policy on human papillomavirus vaccination or issue advice to the National Health Services in the light of recent research by Tomljanovic and Shaw, as it does not materially add to the accepted evidence and views about the safety of HPV vaccine. So basically, what the UK Medical Health Authorities are saying is that we already made up our mind about what we believe to be true about the safety of the vaccine, and there is no evidence you can provide us with that can make us reconsider our views. Now, that's quite of a religious statement based on zero evidence from the top UK medical health authority that is responsible for the safety of drugs.
That is Dr. Lucia Tomljanovic, one of the leading postdoctoral research fellows in the study of the impact of aluminum and other adjuvants on the brain, working at a major neuroscience research institute. We had also heard from Dr. Merrill Nass, board certified, and Dr. Nancy Banks, board certified, on their statements. We're now going into our studio in New York City, where we're both video streaming and broadcasting, where we're joined by Dr. Tony Bark, board certified pediatric physician and prestigious homeopathic physician in Chicago, as well as Luann Panessi, who has been practicing in the healthcare system, in nursing and oriental medicine for more than 36 years. Nice to have you with us, Dr. Bark.
Good afternoon.
First, your responses of what we've heard up to this point from these three research scientists, women, physicians, about the safety and efficacy of the Gardasil or other human papillomavirus vaccines.
How much time do we have? I mean, where do you begin? You know, I know all these women. I know their work. I'm in weekly contact with Lucia as well as Merrill Nass. I have to say that, you know, I trained in pediatrics and ran a pediatric emergency room in the inner city. And, you know, if you came into my emergency room and you didn't vaccinate your kids, I was pretty pissed off. And I actually thought I could call DCFS on that. So I just want to, you know, let you understand that, you know, as a medical student and a resident training in pediatrics, while I was taught, actually, when I was trained in pediatrics in the 80s, I'm that old. When I was trained in pediatrics in the 80s, we were taught that you don't give a vaccine to preemies. You don't give a vaccine to kids who are sick and have fevers, that vaccines can be dangerous. People can die, that SIDS had been linked to the DPT. We were taught that. We were also taught that the chickenpox vaccine would never become mandated or recommended because the risk would definitely far outweigh the benefit. So that was the 80s. Things have changed a lot, but that was prior. When I graduated in 1986, that was the year that the vaccine court came into fruition. So prior to 1986, if you were vaccine damaged, you could sue the vaccine makers. And of course, that changed in 1986. And after that changed, we saw a slew of new vaccines being introduced and being pushed and being fast-tracked. And, you know, I'm getting to the answer to what the question you posed to me, but there's a long story and how we got to this point where we don't have policies that are based on science. They're based on scientism, which is not science. It's ideological belief systems that are not based in reality. We've gotten to a point that's very far from where we started. while there might have been flaws in the vaccine system from the very beginning, and there were, and I can tell you that from the very beginning, 1929, Eli Lilly came up with Thimerosal. Okay, 1929. The one single study that the FDA uses to this day on the safety studies for Thimerosal was done in 1929, and it was given to 27 patients who were all dying of meningitis, and they observed them for a day. And they all died within the next few days. And somehow they declared that Thimerosal is safe based on that one study that is still the one safety study that the FDA uses to hang their hat on Thimerosal. This is how insane the whole thing is. Aluminum has actually been used for decades in our vaccine system. The reason we're seeing much more damage in people and children specifically because they're getting more and more vaccines. So while we've been using them for decades, we're giving many more vaccines, and that list of vaccines are growing, and the vaccines in the pipeline right now are huge. So the pipeline meaning what's in research, and I get updated, you know, updates on a daily basis on what's going on, what's in the pipeline, and it's frightening what's in the pipeline. It's already frightening what we're doing. So we've got from the very beginning poor safety studies. And think about 1929, 1930, where we had advertisements for things like LSD, for, you know, we had advertisements for heroin. Literally, that was that's a trademark, by the way. It was used for cough, considered safe. We go into the 40s and 50s, we had advertisements for thalidomide, a completely safe and effective tranquilizer, safe enough for newborns that not, you know, this, I'm telling you what exists. You can pull up these ads. So the first doctor to kind of blow the whistle on thalidomide when it was going to go over the counter was vilified, completely vilified. She's alive today. She's about 98. She was completely vilified because it was a big moneymaker. So you got to follow the money. And in vaccines, just like the rest of medicine, which, you know, if you look at Cochrane studies and you go to conferences on the industry, and I'm talking about on the industry on the side of people who look at the research, the actual research, you'll see that about 80 to 85% of procedures we do are unnecessary. About 80 to 85% of drugs we're giving are unnecessary and ineffective. And that's at best, because at worst, they're causing more problems than they're pretending to prevent. And when we get to vaccines, this is one complete unethical experiment that is just being pushed on our children. And if you look at bioethics, we have rules about these things. But interestingly enough, that we have seen such egregious behavior in terms of bioethics leading up till very recently and ongoing now with vaccines. The fact that the hepatitis B vaccine was recommended for newborns so the vaccine came out in the 80s. I was actually part of a volunteer, and you know, I took it as a resident in the study. Of course, I actually had no measurable antibodies after the three doses, just so you know. I was at NYU training in peds or rehab at the time. But I mean, that's how much I believed in vaccines, because based on nothing, just based on kind of a truism that was pushed on me in med school and residency. Not that we ever learned anything about vaccines. We didn't. But the Hep B vaccine was created for a population, a high-risk population, drug users, prostitutes. And that's the population it was created for, hoping that this population would voluntarily come in and get this vaccine. That never happened. And so the WHO got together and, you know, talked to governments in different countries and decided, let's try to push this on newborns so we can prevent hepatitis B in high-risk populations down the road. Okay, were there safety studies on newborns? Well, guess what? We don't know, because 10 years ago, Mark Blaxall sent a Freedom of Information Act, an FOIA, to the FDA, along with a few other people, asking for the safety data for newborns, because that's when they decided in about 1989 that it was safe and approved for newborns. We have yet to see any information come forward from the FDA on the safety studies, where how they declared that it was safe to give to newborns. So in 1989, we in most states adopted newborns had to receive the hepatitis B vaccine. That was the recommendation, and it was pushed pretty strongly and still is. And within 2 to 3 years is when we saw the hugest climb in autism that we have seen so far. So that was within 3 years. Now, go to 10 years ago, Vietnam, in about 9 years ago, Vietnam decides they're going to push hepatitis B vaccine on newborns. Well, in the last 8 years, Vietnam's autism rate has gone up 160% just over the last 8 years, just from adding the hep B vaccine day one of life. Hep B vaccine initially created had 50 micrograms of mercury, as well as a full dose of an aluminum adjuvant, along with many other things. I mean, we're talking about viral material and formaldehyde, and I believe 2080, but I'm not sure. But it doesn't matter. Heavy metals in large enough doses do breach the blood-brain barrier and other tight junction barriers. So even without the 2080, which is also called polysorbate, which is known and intentionally used in chemo for the brain because it does breach the blood-brain barrier and carries with it anything that's associated with it, heavy metals on their own will cross the blood-brain barrier and breach tight junctions. So from that vaccine on, we saw a huge jump. And can I tell you also that in the literature, in the pediatric psychiatric literature, you really don't hear anyone describe anything about autism until, I believe, late 30s or early 40s when we started introducing the DPT vaccine. So that, and it was very few. It was a rare, incredibly rare. We're talking about one in 20,000. Then it went to one in 10,000, I think, when I was a child. We are now up to one in 50 in most states around the country. In Utah and New Jersey, it's much higher. So for boys in New Jersey, last I looked, it's probably higher. But last I looked, it was one in 29 boys in the state of New Jersey and also in the state of Utah. And there's reasons for that. New Jersey has Merck, you know, Merck's headquarters is there. And I believe that the local government is quite in cahoots. And of course, we all know that New Jersey has had mandated influenza vaccine for the last several years for preschool and school-aged children in order to go to school that year. So they have more vaccines than any other state mandated. But so we've had now a policy of allowing vaccines to be recommended to groups where we don't have safety studies. We don't have individual safety studies on the ingredients. The adjuvant, aluminum adjuvant, which, and again, Alzheimer's, by the way, has been on the rise with the population that started getting heavily vaccinated, right? If you think about people born in the late 30s, 40s, 50s, this is the population we're seeing with Alzheimer's in an increasing rate. And we do know from neurobiology and histopathology that there's been aluminum noted in the brains in the histopathology postmortem in patients with Alzheimer's. And certainly about 10, 15 years ago, there was a lot of talk about aluminum being associated with Alzheimer's. And yet it's pretty quiet right now. You're not hearing a lot about it. So we've had now several decades of allowing things to be put into our ecology and our environment internally and externally without a precautionary principle. And so in this country, and I believe it's because we're a corporatocracy at this point, where, you know, corporations and lobbyists really control what's happening on the Hill.
That's not corporatocracy. That's fascism.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Back up one moment.
Yeah. See, I could talk forever on this because it's just there were so many issues brought up.
Tony, you mentioned your research at NYU on the hepatitis B vaccine.
I was actually a subject in this study.
Okay. Is there any study that exists that you're aware of that actually proves that the hepatitis B vaccine would help a person such as a prostitute or someone who would be at risk like an intravenous drug user? And if so, how many doses at what level? And what was the surveillance period for those individuals?
Well, you know, I don't know all those answers. I could venture to guess, and I'd rather not because I like to speak what I know. But we don't know a lot about hepatitis. Hepatitis, like HIV, is one of those diseases that if you have antibodies to it, that often means you have it as opposed to you don't have it. And so hepatitis is one of those vaccines. Antibodies are part of the acquired immunity. And so this is something I wanted to bring up anyway. So I'm glad I'm not answering your question per se, but I am giving you information. Antibodies are a part of the acquired immune system. The innate immune system does not use antibodies. It uses natural killer cells. And this is really, the innate system actually can kill any kind of pathogen, whether it's fungal, bacterial, viral, and mycoplasmic. So the innate immune system is the first arm of our immunity and really is where is really what we need to strengthen. The acquired immunity, there's not a lot of evidence that just because you have antibodies to something means that you are immune to it. Just like in some disease, it means you have the disease. So, you know, we're talking out of both sides of our mouth when it comes to antibodies to some degree. And the antibody response is what is termed the efficacy or the antigenic response. And the efficacy is often taken off of that antigenic response. I don't know your answers about the Hep B vaccine, particularly around the do we have any proof that it's prevented hepatitis B? I don't know. And I've never seen anything like that. And yeah. I've done searches and I haven't found them. Doesn't mean they don't exist, but I've never seen them.
We did a worldwide search before commencing the documentary, because I was going to look in the immunological data, because I had a basic question for every single board certified immunologist we interviewed. Can you prove that a vaccination equals immunization that is protective? Not a single person that we interviewed was saying, yes, you're going to have an extended protective period, because in every group, we also found literature that those who had been fully vaccinated also came down with the very condition. Well, then you can't say that everyone's going to be protected. And if you can't say everyone is protected, then what is your gold standard for identifying who to vaccinate, unless you have some biological marker that can be predictive that you will be protected for 3 months, you'll be protected for 30 years, you won't be protected at all. No such science exists.
There's no gold standard. That is absolutely for sure. That I say with certainty. And, you know, getting back to the HPV vaccine, so while it may cover a few strains, when I say cover, there's some antibody response in some of the people who receive it for a few strains. Clearly, if you look at the research 5 years out, there is only one strain where there's antibodies left standing, and that's not in everyone. And the few cases historically that we've seen of cervical cancer in teenage girls, and remember what Lucia said, that it takes 20 to 30 years for a cervical cancer to grow to become cancer. We have now seen, since we've introduced the HPV vaccine into the population, a few cases of teenage girls with cervical cancer, and they all received the vaccine. So what Merck has said is off the record, but I actually think it's on the record at this point, is that so the girls swore that they were virgins, not sexually active. What Merck has said was, we think that they were probably active and had already been exposed. And if you're exposed, oh, well, it might potentiate the virus. Well, if that's the case, how are you going to eliminate, even let's say it even worked. Let's just say it even worked and it wasn't as dangerous as we think it is. If the vaccine is only lasting, you know, if your coverage is just a few years, and if you happen to now be exposed to the virus and then you get another vaccine, a booster, but that potentiates it, it will be potentiating and worsening the cervical cancer situation, not ameliorating it. So it doesn't even make sense to get the vaccine at all. What they're pushing is, what they will be pushing is boosters, of course. You know, that's what they do with all these vaccines.
Going back to your original point you just made, in the studies that I have seen that were principally in the area of HIV infection, and especially at high-risk groups, I looked at the literature for those individuals, young people using no contraception at high risk, teenagers engaged in risky sexual practices, and they had astronomical sexual transmitted disease, no cervical cancer, and also no HIV infection, which was what a lot of scientists, highly respected scientists who were challenging the HIV hypothesis, were suggesting, that it's not sexually transmitted. You're on the wrong track here. Mm-hmm. So to bear a witness to what you just said, if it was true that the few cases that have come about of, let's say, cancer in women, young women who said they never had cancer, then there should be some extrapolated data in the huge number of people who admit to having sex, multiple partners from a very young age, and there is no cervical cancer. Well, how do they address that contradiction?
Well, not only that, Gary, I mean, in the literature, if you do a literature search on cervical cancer in pediatric age groups, there is nothing until the last few years. So there's been nothing. I mean, I trained in pediatrics. There's just not, if you look for a search prior to the introduction of of the Gardasil or the Cervarix vaccine, there was no there were no documented cases of pediatric cervical cancer. So, you know, it just didn't exist. I mean, it takes years for a cervical lesion to become cancer.
Also, they're basing it upon a theoretical model.
It's all based on theoretical models.
So how in the world can you base an entire national vaccine program on a theoretical model that has never been proven, that does not take into account that the vast majority of women who develop human papillomavirus, it will self-regulate mm-hmm. out of the body by the natural immune system? And they're not willing to discuss this. We're coming up to the end of this particular hour of our program. For those of you who are listening, we will take a brief break and continue with part two. I realize most stations will only carry one part at a time because of relegating 55 minutes to a program. So probably tomorrow, most of you will be hearing part two. For those of you who are listening live from the Progressive Radio Network broadcast studios, New York City, we will continue in 60 seconds. My guest at this moment is Dr. Bark, and Dr. Bark is here, Tony Bark, to give her input. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. I welcome you. Today, a special in-depth original investigative report, the safety and efficacy of vaccines in general, but specifically today on the vaccines for the human papillomavirus, including Gardasil. My concern as a public health educator and an advocate of someone who has spent my entire adult career studying phenomena is that I am perplexed at how many millions of individuals are taking a vaccine with the promise that it will prevent cervical cancer and other cancers when there is absolutely no proof to that. There are no long-term studies. We have never gotten to the place where the people who would be protected have met the age requirements of having gone through 25, 30, 35, or 40 years of life before we would see, would a vaccine protect this? We're basing all this upon theoretical and mathematical models. Who creates these? The manufacturer of the vaccines. Who are the experts who testify before Congress, who sit on the FDA and CDC advisory boards? The scientists for hire from the vaccine companies. How is it that almost every state right now and for the past several years has been pushing for mandatory vaccines, in some cases succeeding, like with the flu vaccine, with very high doses, as much as 24 micrograms of thimerosal, the ethyl mercury, that we know is neurotoxic, and now they're promoting Gardasil, because of what is called ALEC. ALEC is an acronym for the American Legislative Exchange Council, a group of 300-plus major multinational corporations who, in secret, for the better part of 35 years, have been having semi-annual meetings with state legislators. They propose to the state legislators bills. They get the state legislators to sign off on the bill in their own secret sessions, legislative sessions. They then go back to their states and then propose these new health measures and make these bills into laws. And because they have multiple state legislators at these ALEC meetings, They generally have bipartisan support, so the public, the media, assume that if they want to mandate a vaccine like Gardasil for all young girls and boys in a state, it's only because of a policy of protecting the citizens based upon sound science and nothing more. Indeed, nothing could be further from the truth. Today, we will be exploring the vaccine's safety and efficacy. This will also be followed by an in-depth article, an original investigative report on the science, or the lack thereof, of the safety and efficacy of Gardasil. It will be posted on our website with one of our scholars in residence and myself. Today's panelists will include Dr. Tony Bark, a pediatric physician, a homeopathic physician practicing in Chicago. She is well known within the homeopathic community. She is a graduate with her medical degree from Rush Medical College, a very prestigious school, and her pediatric internship at New York University. She also has degrees in psychology, as well as a master's degree in healthcare emergency management from Boston University Medical School. Additionally, and her website is disease-reversal.com. She will be joined in studio by Lou M. Panessi. Lou M. Panessi has been an oncological nurse, a nurse administrator at Long Island Jewish Hospital, with more than 100 employees under her, as well as having had a cathartic moment, an epiphany, nearly 19 years ago, where all that she had been taught from a conservative medical background, she was challenged with, and she made a choice. We'll hear about that today in studio. Let's go into the studio and say hello to Lou Ann Panessi. Hi, Lou Ann.
Hello, Gary.
First, Lou Ann, tell us about your original conservative and orthodox mainstream training, what you were trained in, what your responsibilities were. What were your truths? What did you see working every day in a hospital setting? And then what was your day of challenge?
Well, I started out right out of a baccalaureate degree, a four-year baccalaureate degree program. And within the first year of working at this New York City Medical Center, I went into leadership because I just felt like I could help everybody with all their big problems. I could see the big picture. But I was basing this on the information that I received from my university. And, of course, when you're going to a university and you're learning this information, you want to believe that what they're telling you is based in good science. So I took all the sciences. We took sociology, psychology. We took all the courses. And I just said, okay, all right, yeah. So when I started working in the hospital, I was presented with a bunch of policies and procedures. And in order to be a management or a leadership person or administrative person, you had to know the procedures and you had to know the policies and you had to make sure that your staff that you oversaw was adhering to them. So in order for me to maintain my status in the hospital, I followed the rules. I did what they said. And if they said everyone's got to go and get a TB test, everyone went and got a TB test. If someone stuck themselves with a needle, we ran off and gave them a tetanus shot. This is what we did. And I pretty much, again, you know, we want to believe that what they're telling us is in our best interest. And I believed that for 18 years.
What was your turning point?
Well, my turning point was when I was diagnosed with bilateral breast lesions. I had picked up hepatitis B from an emergency patient that was cardiac arresting in the hallway, and all of us ended up getting hepatitis B from them. I had chronic fatigue syndrome. I had very severe adult acne with pockmarks, and I had mycoplasma pneumonia. Every time the seasons changed, I had some kind of a very severe upper respiratory illness. And it got to a point where I was drinking 13 cups of coffee a day and a lot of chocolate to stay awake all day, because that's what we give nurses when we discharge from the hospital. We give them coffee and chocolate. And that's what I lived on. That and the leftovers of what the interns had at their lunch and learn from the FDA. So that's usually pizza or Chinese food. And that's pretty much what I subsisted on. and it took its toll on my body. I was hypothyroid, so I always carried a little extra weight. And it was when they told me that I had these bilateral breast lesions, I finally just said, you know what? I'm not going to become one of the statistics. I was very much used to going out as a staff nurse and administering medications. And nurses are so busy. They don't have time to sit and look up every drug and interaction with what other drug. Many patients don't tell us if they're taking herbs or vitamins. We just pretty much follow the doctor's orders. And we go out there and we administer these medications. And many times our geriatric population would be pretty much sedated, propped up in a geriatric chair, and put on display until we were ready to put them in bed. And that's pretty much how we did it. Our immunosuppressed patients getting chemotherapy were, unfortunately, they were given their chemotherapies. And we were told not to have plants in the room, don't give them any live foods because we didn't want them to get infected. And I just watched people come in, get medicated, and die. And it was that combined with my own chronic illnesses that finally got me to say, you know what, I'm not going to be a statistic. I'm going to make some changes. And that's when I started getting interested in alternative medicine, integrative nursing, and it opened up a whole new field of information that I had no idea existed.
All right. When did you begin to question vaccines? And what was your assignment? What did you do in the way of research to confirm that they were safe or not, efficacious or not?
Shortly after I left the hospital to open up a wellness center in New York City, I needed to make a choice. I needed to say, are my staff going to go out and get vaccinated or not? And it was right around the time when we started having mandatory vaccination for nurses and other healthcare workers. Not just healthcare workers, though. This was also for the maintenance staff, housekeeping staff, administrative staff, anyone who walked through the hospital doors were expected to get vaccinated. And I just felt responsible for looking into this. And that's where my journey began. So when I went up on the internet and I started reading about what the CDC had to say about vaccines, the FDA, they had all of this embellished literature about how safe it was and we should all be getting our vaccines. But I didn't see any science. The science that I did see, I went a little bit deeper to say, who are these physicians doing these tests, doing the testing on these vaccines, and what kind of results did they get? It turned out that the great majority of these physicians were actually hired by the FDA. So they become their own watchdogs. So they can do whatever the heck they want. And that troubled me. That troubled me very deeply. I almost felt like I was being used by the FDA because that opened up a whole Pandora's box for me. I had to start questioning every medical study, not just vaccines, but what about the studies on all the other drugs that we're giving people? What about the studies on chemotherapy, about all these antiretrovirals that we're giving to people with HIV? I learned so much that I ended up studying this now for about 2 years. I then found another whole stream of information through independent scientific research. And that really opened my eyes.
Okay, a few quick questions. Have you found any literature anywhere that is independent that supports the safety and efficacy of any individual vaccine or combination of vaccines?
Absolutely not.
Would you take a vaccine today?
I would never take a vaccine.
Have you found independent literature that shows that vaccines are harmful to any individual or group? Or lacking efficacy as individuals or groups?
Absolutely. That's what the independent literature shows us. It shows us the actual ingredients of the vaccines that are directly correlated with toxicity, cancers. There's no studies done, or very few that I've seen, on the effects of fertility when people get vaccines. Will it affect your ability to conceive? And there's a whole population of women out there that are having problems conceiving, and they're all loaded with vaccines.
Have you realized how many senior citizens now are suffering from Alzheimer's, and that for the last 20 years, we have had a heavy program of vaccinating seniors with one or two flu vaccines, giving them between 24 to 48 micrograms of thimerosal ethyl mercury, which is known to be neurodestructive.
Catherine Fromprovich is a researcher that wrote a huge article, and her conclusion is this. It seems that consistent high-level protection is elusive, including that there's evidence for protection in adults 65 years of age or older who represent 90% of deaths from the flu is lacking. There's no evidence that these things work.
Thank you. Now we're going over and say hello in studio to a woman who is out there taking her thoughts to the American public, Dr. Tony Bark, pediatric physician, and she's in our studio. Nice to have you with us, Tony.
Hi, how are you?
Tony, explain to this audience your concern about our current vaccine programs in the United States for all individual vaccines and then combinations of vaccines, including the DPT and the MMR. And one last thing, how is it anybody could justify giving a baby just born whose mother has shown no antibodies to hepatitis B, giving them a vaccine for what is likely to be a sexually transmitted disease or intravenous drug-using disease in a brand-new baby whose mother has none of that? How does that benefit the child, but what does it do to the child to introduce through all natural barriers in a non-differentiated, completely immature immune system that might take 2 to 3 years to develop, take all those toxins right into the baby's body?
It does nothing to benefit the child, and it was never intended, by the way, to benefit the newborn or the newborn as a child. The intention of that vaccine was and always has been to potentially reduce hepatitis B in an adult high-risk population. So basically, we are sacrificing and experimenting with our newborns to potentially, supposedly, protect them 10, 20, 30, 40 years down the road if they become prostitutes or IV drug users. So it was never, you know, the intention of that vaccine was never for newborns. And again, I've said this before in public, that the safety studies that the FDA used to approve that for newborns is nowhere to be found and has been requested for over 10 years ago and is still nowhere to be found. But that vaccine was always intended for a high-risk population, but they never came in to get the vaccine. And so, oh, well, let's force it on the newborns. And that way, you know, in 20, 30 years, when some of these become high-risk, you know, IV drug users or prostitutes, will reduce our hepatitis B, not even knowing if the antibodies last that long, one. And then, two, not even having any safety studies on newborns. And so, you know, it's one thing you could say in a high-risk female population where there was no prenatal testing and it's endemic. So in parts of Asia, you could argue, at least make some kind of concise argument that makes some kind of sense that, oh, we're in an endemic area of China, let's say, where the hepatitis B population is, the women infected is very high and they don't get prenatal care. Let's vaccinate the babies. At least there would be an argument that you could see that would be plausible. But we have no argument here at all. And so when I had my son, and I was not where I am today on the stance of vaccines, but I also knew, being a pediatrician and running an emergency room, that babies can have very severe reactions to vaccines. I said, you're not vaccinating my child. And I said, why do you even want to? I mean, I've had prenatal care. And the doctor looked at me and said, I don't know. You know, I don't know. What I've been told when I've questioned people in authority, they'll say, well, you know, if the woman became exposed during her pregnancy, it could take months to seroconvert. And I said, so you're telling me that you're not trusting the woman who says, no, I'm just having sex with my partner and I have not gone off to do IV drug use or prostitute myself during this pregnancy. You know, just in case they've lied about that. I mean, it's so degrading and paternalistic. If that's really what's going on in how some people justified in their minds. But so that, to answer that last question, is that there's no benefit to the child and never has been the intention of that.
Then the question is, What proof from the independent literature do we have for the safety and efficacy to any given individual for every vaccine? Polio, measles, mumps, rubella, you know, go through the list and show what the literature, the actual quality literature, we all recognize now. The official literature from manufacturers of a product cannot be trusted.
Absolutely. And in most of those cases, by the way, they don't even pretend to have safety studies on these vaccines or schedules. So it's not even that there is ghost, you know, researchers doing the work as a PR machine. So in many cases, we don't even have the studies. They're just not there, let alone bad studies. We do have people like Peter Abe, who's a well-known vaccinologist who was sent by the WHO in Africa about 30 years ago to study measles. And he noticed lots of children dying after the measles vaccine and was able to persuade the maker of that vaccine at the time to change their formulation. He's also published numerous articles on the DBT vaccine and how girls in the first year of life are 20 times more likely to die. Actually, girls up, I think, up until the age of 7 or maybe even older are more likely to die, 20 times more likely to die within the first year after receiving a DPT vaccine. So we have plenty of literature on individual vaccines and on the schedule that shows that it is not safe, that they're not safe, that there'll be a good many people who have serious consequences to vaccines. And even in the not serious consequences, we have no idea. So autoimmune diseases have risen exponentially. And since 1986, when we put through the vaccine court, which made, no pun intended, all the vaccine makers immune to lawsuits, we have pushed through many more vaccines and being able to obtain fast tracking for many vaccines, which, by the way, as a disaster manager, I can tell you that the fast track was created for events, bioterrorist events, or dangerous, lethal pandemic events. That's what the fast track was created for, and that's certainly not what's happening with fast track. So we don't have good studies. The studies we have that are done independently show these diseases to be risky. We also know from looking at autoimmune statistics that since we put through this vaccine court and the number of vaccines has risen, that autoimmunity has risen around at the same rate. And so asthma, ADD, which isn't looked at as an autoimmune disease, but might very well be based on some studies that we have on neuropathology postmortem. But ulcerative colitis, Crohn's, we're seeing children now. There's been a few cases of girls who've received the HPV vaccine who have ALS. So Lou Gehrig's disease, we're seeing a rise in MS in France and in some European countries. There was a connection made between MS and the hepatitis B vaccine, day one of life. So all autoimmune diseases are sharply on the rise and rising as we increase our vaccine policy, you know, change our vaccine policies to increasing vaccines and push vaccines and boosters on children. And we are now working the powers that be, the pharma and the CDC are working around the clock, honestly, to come up with ways of pushing all adults to receive vaccines on a regular basis. And this is where we're headed. We're headed towards mandated vaccines for healthcare workers, which we know is now in existence, whether it's state mandated or not. And it's most states do not mandate it, but it's mandated at the individual hospital level. And Medicare and Medicaid starting, I think, next year will no longer, you'll be reimbursed if you're a hospital by a reduction in 10% of your reimbursement if 90% or more of your staff is not vaccinated against the flu. But we're going to see this push in all federal workers now for flu vaccine. That's what they want to do. That's the new suggestion, is that all federal workers receive yearly flu vaccines, even though the studies on the flu vaccine show it to be basically worthless at best. And I say at best because at worst, you're going to have some people who are going to die, have acute asthmatic reactions, who will have Guillain-Barré. There are risks to every vaccine, and that is recognized, which is why they're listed as unavoidably unsafe. The real agenda right now is to not only increase the number of vaccines on children, increase the boosters. So the push now is to get junior high students back to repeat all their vaccines because we know the vaccines fail. And so we have outbreaks of pertussis, measles, and mumps, mostly those three diseases, in fully vaccinated populations. What the public hears is there's outbreaks of pertussis. You know, shame on the parents who didn't vaccinate their kids, but it's irrelevant. It's not happening on the unvaccinated. The majority of outbreaks in pertussis, mumps, and measles are happening in fully vaccinated populations. And so what quietly they're saying is, oh gosh, these antibodies are waning and there's really no protection out after 3, 4, or 5 years. We need now junior high students to come in and we need adults to come in. Because if you believe in the herd immunity and the vaccines only work for a few years, there's no such thing as the herd immunity because we've been walking around, you know, most people are walking around, the adults are getting vaccinated and they're not immune. You know, supposedly, according to vaccinology. So we are seeing no safety studies that are done except by independent researchers, and those do not bode well for vaccines. And we have a lot of shenanigans going on. And so and I'll give you two really good examples of the shenanigans. When you do safety studies for vaccines, so phase one in a vaccine trial is just to look at the antibody response, or the antigenicity, which is often then said to be the efficacy, which is then extrapolated to be the effectiveness. But when you do that, you do give a real saline, a real placebo. So, you know, one group gets the vaccine, the other group gets saline injection, and then they measure antibody levels. That's phase one. But when you do phase two and three, which are harms trials, to look at the potential attributable rate of disease based from the vaccine exposure, what you now start seeing is really crazy behavior. And so the placebos are no longer the saline. They are now the adjuvant, the aluminum adjuvant. So in the HPV vaccine, the girls received the aluminum adjuvant. In the HPV vaccine for the boys received twice the dose of the aluminum adjuvant. And no wonder 10 boys have died in 1 year out of 2000. We've had 10 boys die in the placebo group. Prevnar, that came out a few years ago or many years ago at this point, the harms trial vaccine, the placebo was an experimental, unapproved, never approved, by the way, meningococcal C vaccine. That was the placebo. How do you figure out the attributable rate of any consequence when you don't even know what the attributable rate of that vaccine is? It makes no sense. So we have a lot of crazy behavior. What people read is, what pediatricians or doctors read is that, oh, against the placebo, the death rate was the same, the autoimmune disease, the asthma wasn't any higher in the test group, and so it's safe. It's the background noise of disease in a normal population. But we know that's not true. It's been manipulated. And so we have examples of these just egregious methodological design studies, then how do you believe anything? So once you start heading down this road and investigating and reading for yourself, you come quickly to realize that because there's so much fudging, there's bias created in the design itself. The placebo is not a placebo. We want the placebo group to have a high rate of illness, so we'll give them a toxin or a potential toxin. Once you realize that kind of behavior is going on and the FDA is colluding with them, I mean, the FDA knows, it's presented, they read supposedly, but the FDA has an advisory committee, as does the CDC. The advisory committees are all but one employees of the industry themselves. There's usually one consumer advocate who, if you interviewed them behind closed doors, would tell you very scary stories on all these committees. So you have the FDA colluding. You have the CDC colluding. You have a revolving door between people at the FDA, the CDC, and the HHS, where they then become a highly paid lobbyist for the industry, or they get taken on as head of vaccine in the industry itself at Glaxo or Merck or, you know, Wyeth, you name it, any of these places. But the lobbyists make huge money. There's numerous lobbyists, way more lobbyists on the Hill for pharma than we have senators and congressmen on the Hill. And there's a huge amount of money. They can outspend the government. They can certainly outspend NGOs who are patient advocates and consumer advocates. And so when you look at a lot of these fudge studies and realize there's really no safety studies that are done at all or done with real methodology, then you have to wonder, is everything been fudged? Because maybe there are some good vaccines. Maybe there are some safe vaccines. But who the hell knows? I mean, who knows? There's no way of knowing, because anywhere you look, it's not there. So again, starting with, you know, a poor, ridiculous study on thimerosal in 1929 as the basis to use it as a safe ingredient when we know mercury is toxic, to aluminum, where we know aluminum is a neurotoxin. And yet, if you interview people in the aluminum adjuvant office at the NIH, like I have, and been told, this is what I was told, no, we haven't done safety studies on aluminum, no, we haven't looked at them, but the FDA would never approve a dangerous vaccine. That's what I was told by Dr. Cedar at the NIH. Now, I have then forwarded studies, Chris Shaw and Lucia Tomenovich's studies on aluminum adjuvants and Chris Exley's studies. I've not heard back, but you know, if that's indicative of the average worker at the NIH and the CDC, either their head is in the sand, they're in a bubble, there's ego, you know, there's some kind of dissonance where they don't want to look at it because, you know, they don't want to think of themselves as contributing to maiming people or killing people. But also, I believe that the government and the drug companies are very smart and that they might have 10 doctors working on a vaccine. The two doctors that really are specialists in HPV, and this happened with Gardasil, Diane Harper truly was in the right place, right? I mean, she is a specialist on cervical cancer and HPV. She helped design the Gardasil vaccine. She had no idea that the adjuvant was a toxic aluminum. You know, she had no idea. I mean, that wasn't the part she was creating. So it's the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. It's very clear that a lot of these researchers do work in a bubble. I believe that not everyone is corrupt. Not everyone is stupid. There are people at the FDA and the CDC who would probably want to speak out, but they have no whistleblower protection. And when whistleblower protection for federal workers came up 2 years ago, it was put on a secret hold. It passed in December, with the exception of whistleblower protection for people who work in healthcare. So they only get military whistleblower protection, which, as many of us now know, with all these rape cases coming out, that military whistleblower protection is basically no whistleblower protection. So we don't hear a lot from the FDA and CDC and NIH whistleblowers, but we do hear some from them. And I was able to hear from two FDA whistleblowers about 3 weeks ago in Washington, D.C. And really what you hear is that there's a culture of rubber stamping, and that if you point out a new drug or vaccine to be dangerous, you are demoted, taken off that project. And if you continue on, you are fired. This happens in academia. I listened to a few whistleblowers from academia, and the stories are frightening. And really frightening, because they really can ruin your life. I mean, they vilify you, even if you're in academia and you're tenured. If you're working on something that's getting a grant, let's say your department's getting $500,000 grant yearly to develop a vaccine or to develop a new drug, and you blow the whistle on the dangers, you are vilified and stripped of your license, and the medical board comes after you. I mean, it's very scary why, you know, one can understand how there are so many people working in this field, and once they realize the dangers, they don't come forward. They're afraid to speak about it. But there's also this dissonance where they don't want to look at the dangers because they'd have to change how they think about the whole system they're in. And then there is working in a bubble, not knowing what the left hand's doing.
You're listening to Dr. Tony Bark, B-A-R-K. We're now going to go to Australia. We're standing by is a scientist, one of the most senior scientists that we know of, talking about vaccines. We're going to take a brief break, come back, and then speak with Dr. Verena Schreiber, very outstanding person on the subject. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Now we're going to go to Australia, in a suburb of Sydney, where one of the world's leading experts on vaccination is standing by. She is Dr. Vera Schreiber. She is a retired principal research scientist in Australia. She is now one of the world's leading experts on the faulty science and adverse effects of vaccines in general, and in their individual ingredients in particular. And frequently she has served as an expert witness in court cases related to death and injuries caused by vaccines. She has published two major texts on vaccines, Vaccination, 100 Years of Orthodox Research, as well as Behavioral Problems in Childhood, The Link to Vaccination. She has also published nearly 90 scientific peer-reviewed papers in the literature. Her website is Vera, V-I-E-R-A, Scheibner, S-C-H-I-E-B-N-E-R.org, or VeraScheibner.com, or VeraScheibner.net. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice being on your show, Gary.
Since we're here to talk about Gardasil specifically, I also felt that maybe you could give us some insights into the general safety and efficacy of most individual or combination vaccines like the DPT or the MMR, and so before we go into Gardasil.
Well, I would start with this. Number one, all my information comes from the study of orthodox medical research published in the most reputable medical journals of the likes of The Lancet, British Medical Journal, Journal of Infectious Diseases, etc. That's very important because people generally don't know that there has been a lot of good medical research performed which points out to the general characteristics of all vaccines. Reactions to all vaccines are subject to a so-called non-specific stress syndrome, meaning that the reactions are characteristic but not specific, not specific to any one vaccine. And that includes the DPT vaccine, hepatitis B, all those meningitis type vaccines and polio vaccine, and including the Gardasil vaccine or human papillomavirus vaccine. So because the body has a limited repertory of reactions. Another thing to consider is that the HPV vaccine is given at an age when the recipients already have received a lot of other vaccines. So their immune system has been damaged, has been hyped up by the previously administered vaccines. So the reaction to HPV vaccine may be more intense and more dangerous than they might have experienced to the previous vaccines. It's called sensitization, but it is the wrong sensitization, meaning it actually is an increased susceptibility to the diseases which the vaccine is purported to prevent, and also to a host of related and unrelated bacterial and viral infections. So that's why you see very serious reactions to this HPV vaccine, which include paralysis and death. Now, this non-specific stress syndrome is one of the best established concepts in medicine. It was developed and researched extensively by Dr. Hans Scheye, a Canadian medical doctor of Austro-Hungarian origin, who already, as a medical student, noticed that when rats are injected with any substances, and including formaldehyde, which is in most vaccines, they will develop the same pathological findings, the same pathology and symptomatology. And he tried many substances. He always got the same results. And that is very valid for all vaccines. So there is no difference between reactions to DPT vaccines or polio and HPV, with one element to consider, that by the time girls, and now apparently the boys are going to, by the time the girls are given HPV vaccine, their immune system has already been deranged, sensitized, damaged by previous vaccines.
What has been your experience in trying to bring your findings of the danger of vaccines and the lack of efficacy to the general scientific community and to physicians or pediatricians in particular?
Well, I mentioned the word increased susceptibility to the targeted disease, but also to related and unrelated bacterial and viral infections. And this is very important finding, that vaccines do not even prevent diseases, because many people will vaccinate and say, okay, we have to accept the risk that something will happen, etc. but at least my child will not get whooping cough, measles, or cervical cancer, you name it. That is not true. No vaccine, including the HPV vaccines, never, ever prevented at the targeted disease. Indeed, the incidence of these so-called vaccine-preventable diseases has increased with vaccination. That includes one of the first diseases, whooping cough disease, when the individual states in the United States gradually mandated DPT and polio vaccination. That was in the mid-70s. The falling incidence of whooping cough for the last 100 years, the falling incidence of whooping cough stopped, and the curve actually went up. So increased within those few mid-70s years, the incidence of whooping cough increased 300%, and all in the vaccinated children. The same happened with all the other vaccines, including measles vaccine. So it may happen that the HPV vaccine will increase the incidence of cervical cancer, and there are already reports to that sense. And also, of course, it takes many years sometimes to get enough statistics, to get enough cases to see the trend. But so if the girls or their parents expect the HPV vaccine to protect their children from cervical cancer, please don't hold your breath, because the vaccine has no ability. It has no quality. It has no appropriate characteristics to prevent cervical cancer.
We have been led to believe as a society, in fact, the entire population of the world has been told vaccination is the same as immunization. And if you get your scheduled shots, you are strengthening your immune system so that when you encounter someone with chickenpox, smallpox, polio, measles, whooping cough, you'll be protected. And if enough people, you'll have a herd protection. They use the three examples of the success of vaccination as a public health measure: smallpox, polio, and measles. Would you offer your opinion on their argument that those three diseases were eradicated due to vaccination and nothing else?
I will start with the term herd immunity. The term herd immunity was coined in 1933 at the time when there was no measles vaccines, and the researchers were looking at the incidence of the natural measles disease. And they established that when two-thirds of susceptible children get measles, an epidemic stops. Then it takes 2-3 years before, again, two-thirds of susceptibles will accumulate, and then there comes an epidemic, and it will end when those susceptibles will have gone through measles. But of course, I emphasize again, they looked at the incidence of natural measles. That doesn't apply to vaccines, because first of all, vaccines do not prevent any diseases. They cause them. So it came as no surprise that the incidence of all those so-called vaccine-preventable diseases, whether whooping cough, measles, etc., actually went up after vaccination was introduced in mass proportions. So there will be an increase of the disease, whichever it is, when they start vaccinating. And HPV is no exception. And the herd immunity does not apply to vaccines. Now, people use interchangeably vaccination and immunization. That's totally wrong, because vaccination is simply the act of administering the vaccine. Immunization is the process of acquiring immunity. Now you know from what I said that by vaccinating, you don't acquire any immunity. If anything, your immunity is damaged. So you, by vaccinating children, you are not creating a herd immunity. Definitely not. If anything, you are creating a far-reaching herd lack of immunity. So vaccines do not immunize, they de-immunize. They damage, suppress, weaken the immune system.
address the issue of the eradication of smallpox, of polio, and of measles, and their argument that it is only the single vaccine that did this, what would be your counterbalancing argument?
First of all, smallpox. The biggest epidemics of smallpox occurred right after mass vaccination drives. There are exceptions which prove the rule, meaning not it was the town of Leicester in England where people revolted. They refused smallpox vaccination, and it stopped the occurrence of smallpox. So there is no evidence whatsoever that smallpox vaccine even had the ability to eradicate smallpox. And smallpox was eradicated by better nutritional status of people, particularly better vitamin status of people. Let's not forget the staple diet of people in the old world, which is basically Europe and England, was bread. No vegetables, no fruit, only some meat. And of course, people were scurvy. The life expectancy until the so-called horticultural revolution, which was the introduction of vegetables and fruit into the staple diet, particularly the sauerkraut, the fermented form of cabbage, very rich in vitamin C, the life expectancy until that time was only about 33 years. And after people started eating sauerkraut together with bread and meat as a staple diet, the life expectancy doubled to 67 years. And when you consider that the healthy life expectancy in most of the so-called developed countries is only around 67 to 70 years, well, that is not a credit to modern medicine or even the modern nutritional knowledge. So smallpox stopped because of better nutritional and vitamin C status, and vaccination against smallpox was discontinued because the reactions to the vaccine outweighed even those supposed non-existent benefits of vaccination. Actually, in the early 2000s, the United States introduced smallpox vaccination. They had to stop because people were dying from it, from heart failure. So it was killing people. And of course, the United States people, the people in the United States, they are probably the most highly vaccinated people in the world, already sensitized, damaged by previous vaccinations. And that's why when they started giving smallpox vaccine, people were dying from it and they had to stop. The same story applies to polio. First of all, poliomyelitis was originally called provocation disease, caused by injections of other vaccines. So injections of diphtheria vaccine resulted in paralysis. If I take the modern example, reactions to HPV vaccine often result in paralysis. In the olden days, they would have called it poliomyelitis. Now they call it Guillain-Barré syndrome. And poliomyelitis is a provocation disease caused by other vaccines. All major drives, vaccination drives, in developing and developed countries resulted within a few days in major outbreaks of paralysis in the vaccinated children, particularly after the first dose of the vaccine. 65% of cases of paralysis straight after major polio vaccination drives were in the vaccinated children. And of course, what they did, they started manipulating the figures. They said because one needs three doses of the polio vaccine to be fully immunized, then children who got paralysis after the first vaccine were unimmunized. In other words, they were not fully immunized. I mean, this is an outrageous manipulation of data because that way they excluded those 65%, all those children who developed paralysis from the polio vaccine as unvaccinated. They even included it in their calculations and came up with some 85% effectiveness of the vaccine. And this is published in particularly in the journal called Lancet, a very reputable British medical journal. But because you can follow the trail of manipulation, you can see exactly what happened there. At least they published it truthfully, in the sense admitting that they excluded all children who developed paralysis after the first dose as unvaccinated. So polio is actually caused by vaccination. This provocation disease is still being published, particularly in countries like Romania, where they truthfully admitted that the outbreaks of paralysis after polio vaccination were actually provoked by the injections of other vaccines.
My final question for you, Dr. Scheibner, is there are thousands of scientific papers they claim show the safety and efficacy of vaccines. How do you address their science?
There are two types of orthodox medical scientific research papers. Those that say the truth and those who manipulate the truth. So I already said, if you exclude 65% of those who recipients of the vaccines who develop paralysis from calculations of efficacy as unvaccinated, boy, oh boy, you will get very high efficacy of the vaccine. But if you admit it, that's a good research. If you don't admit it, that's an invalid research. And so half of those papers, and I'm just approximate the figures, half of those papers published about the vaccines would be either fraudulent, where they do not admit the manipulation of data, and then the other half will be where they admit the manipulation of the data. So you can't trust all papers just on the face value. You have to go deeply into their statistics, into their calculations, and in their methods, how they achieved those results.
I appreciate very much you taking your time over in Australia for being on with us today. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest, Dr. Vera Scheibner, and she is in Australia right now. Back in a moment. I apologize that we had a little static, but it was a call to Australia, and it was what it was. Certainly, you were able to hear the importance of her challenge. Final thought from Dr. Tony Bark in studio in New York, listening to Dr. Scheibner's report.
You know, Vera is great. I've been following her work for a long time. I want to kind of maybe clarify something that might have seemed confusing for some people, is that the provoked paralysis that we're seeing from vaccines is provoked paralysis from vaccines. Exactly that. Some of you will say, especially if you're old enough, well, I remember outbreaks of polio. Well, really, if you look at literature and try to find out even historically, like in historical novels and stories, polio did not really, we don't see outbreaks until the 30s, until we started vaccinating against the diphtheria and tetanus. And so the theory is that it's the initial DT that either made us more susceptible to the polyvirus or actually triggered Guillain-Barré.
I would say that in the best developed nations, the life expectancy is about 77, 78. In a few countries, it's in the early 80s for women. But we also know that it wasn't just fermented cabbage. It was starting to improve sanitation overall, getting the people who died out of the cities and buried deep, getting the water purified, getting more fruits and vegetables, creating roads that allowed produce to be exchanged. There was a lot that improved sanitation. We'll deal with that on an upcoming program. But we're out of time. And I want to thank you, Dr. Tony Bark.
Thank you.
And her website is disease-reversal.com. Also, Dr. Nancy Banks, Dr. Lucia Tomanovich, Dr. Merrill Nash, and all the other voices, including Luann Panessi, that contributed to this special two-hour version. If you missed anything, go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'm Gary Nall from our studios in New York City. Thank you all very much for listening.